Migration is all over the news. Syrian refugees are clogging Europe's borders. The U.S. has built walls to keep out Mexicans. Meanwhile, countries around the world pour money into policing their borders while a global black market smuggles people across them for money. I'm Anne Strange-Champs, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, something about this doesn't make sense. What if there was another way?
My dangerous idea is that borders are a thing of the past.
Artist and activist Molly Crabapple.
What we're seeing now with the Syrians and the Afghans and the Eritreans risking their lives to come to Europe is about war and it's about poverty, but it's not just about that. It's about something else, something bigger. We live in a time when we can communicate with anyone in the world. In our hands, we hold phones that have the sum total of human knowledge that give us this Gnostic and bodiless power to see anywhere and speak to anyone, anywhere, regardless of borders. And yet, our identities are chained more than ever to borders. We in the first world, we with the lucky blue passports, we carry passports that have chips in them. Everything about us is tracked. Borders are these spaces that are so militarized. And it's all about dividing the rich world from the poor world. But the thing is that in a time when people's minds can go anywhere, people's bodies cannot be chained in this way, people will no longer respect the idea that borders were sacrosanct. And in fact, the idea of a border being sacrosanct is a very, very, very modern invention. So let's say, you know, you're someone like a young Syrian engineer that I met in a refugee camp in Iraqi Kurdistan. He speaks English. He is highly educated. He fought for an education against all odds because he's part of a persecuted ethnic group, and he got that education. He has a good job, and then war comes and strips everything from him. And him and his whole family are living in a tent or in a shack in this expanse of dusty tents and shacks, and there's no future available for them. ISIS is maybe like 50 miles away, but even if they're technically safe, there's just nothing for them. There's nothing, you know? And this person, they have skills. They speak English. They speak like a bunch of languages. They had a future that was in mind for them. They have a young sister that wants to be a doctor. They have all of this ambition and potential and talent, and they're stuck in this camp with nothing because of the book of paper they hold. How can you tell someone like that not to get on a boat to Europe? How can you tell someone like that that because of the spot of land that you were born on or because of, you know, the mother you came from or whatever, you have less of a right to human dignity, to free movement and to happiness than someone else just by virtue of the fact that you were born on a poor spot of land and I was born on a rich spot of land? Anyone who fundamentally believes that humans are created equal must deeply question the idea that citizenship to certain countries, to certain rich countries, has to grant you privileges. Anyone who believes that humans are created equal has to look at the Afghans and the Syrians, the families, the men, the women, the little kids that are paying $2,000 to smugglers because they're not allowed to go on a death boat, because they're not allowed to buy plane tickets because they come from poor countries, and then look at the own freedom with which they travel the world, a freedom that's totally born from coming from an empire, and think, my God, there's something wrong here.
That's artist and activist Molly Crabapple. So what would be a better way? Well, there's a concept some people are starting to take seriously called open borders. The basic idea is that anyone who isn't a criminal is allowed to live and work in any other country. Producer Raymond Tangakar is here to explain it. Raymond, is this actually a serious proposal?
It is. You know, while researching the subject, I came across this group of largely libertarian economists at George Mason University who actually promote this idea. And to them, it's not, you know, just some pie-in-the-sky idea. It's something with clear, tangible benefits to the world. I want to take a second to introduce you to an economist named Brian Kaplan. And he believes that by getting rid of borders, not only can you double world GDP, you can actually end global poverty. And here's what his argument boils down to.
You are wasting human talent. You know, there are countries where the most talented person in the world would see their talent go to waste. There's other places where they can move, where they can use their talent to its full effect. And really what Open Borders says is if someone wants to move from a place where they aren't able to contribute much to the world to a place where they contribute a lot, let them. Think about, someone's working in Haiti where they're able to produce maybe a few dollars worth of value per day. If that you can just move them over to Miami, it is very easy for that very one and the same person the next day to be producing 10 times as much. Just in terms of, shining shoes or cleaning houses. In Haiti, the value of that is very low. In Miami, the value of that is much higher. Of course, this is even more obvious for something like agriculture in Mexico, where the amount of food that a Mexican farmer can grow in Mexico is a very small amount. The amount that very same farmer can grow if you just let him move into Texas or California is many times greater.
But Raymond, there's not an unlimited amount of jobs in the U.S. I mean, I don't understand how this wouldn't just suck up jobs from American workers and push down wages and eventually tank the economy.
That's a fair point. And, even presidential candidate Bernie Sanders says that this policy would hurt American workers. But, advocates of open borders say that, it would hurt people in the short term, but the economy would recover. And Kaplan says that this is the way progress has always worked.
For any time that there's an increase in productivity, anything, there's always going to be some people that are hurt. So, for example, Uber right now is hurting people who are traditional taxi cab drivers. And when driverless cars come around, Uber drivers are going to suffer from this. In the same way, the tractor has been bad for people who were horse breeders, as well as people who worked in traditional agriculture. Look, if we were always trying to stop any kind of change that made somebody worse off, we really would still be back in the pre-industrial era.
This is where the open borders concept gets really interesting. Because once you accept that some American workers will be hurt in the short term, you can design policies to actually compensate them. You can charge immigrants higher tax rates and use the money to compensate American workers who've lost out. Or you can even charge admission to enter the U.S.
Right now, people pay a lot of money to get smuggled into the United States in great danger and with no guarantee of getting in. You could go and charge very similar rates to just let people walk across the border legally or take a bus across legally, get a piece of paper, pay a fee, and again, use that money to take care of Americans that you think are losing out.
Admission fee makes America sound like a theme park. But aside from the economics of open borders, I would think there'd be a huge security risk. I mean, isn't it like just an open invitation to ISIS to walk right in?
Well, open borders doesn't mean that you can't police borders. I mean, people would still need to clear security in order to get in. So it's not like anyone with a criminal record or a recipe for a fertilizer bomb could just walk right in. But I guess for me, the biggest objection that I hear is feasibility. If you were to get rid of borders overnight, what I imagine would happen is you would have 100 million people approaching the U.S. border to get in, and that would just be a disaster. But Brian points out that you don't have to do this overnight. You can phase it in over time, over the course of a decade or two. And not only that, he says we actually already did this once.
We did?
Yeah, Puerto Rico.
So in 1902, there's an obscure Supreme Court decision that said that Puerto Ricans, since the United States had taken Puerto Rico as a territory in the Spanish-American War, Supreme Court said that any Puerto Rican was totally free to move to the United States and work here if they wanted. Over the decades, the number of Puerto Ricans coming increased and increased and increased until now over half of all people of Puerto Rican ancestry actually live in the United States. By having open borders, this paved the way for a lot of U.S. investment in Puerto Rico. A lot of Puerto Rican migrants went and started businesses in Puerto Rico or set up retirement homes there. The effect has been incredibly good. So Puerto Rico is, by Caribbean standards, a fantastic place. And again, not just for the Puerto Ricans who left, but of course, for the Puerto Ricans who stayed behind as well.
Raymond, I know you did some checking around. You talked with some other economists. What's the biggest credible objection to open borders, in your view?
Well, I think it has to do with this idea that once you actually reach America, I mean, that's it. You've reached the promised land and the work is done. But in fact, actually, that's just the beginning, right? Because someone has to do the hard work of actually integrating these migrants into society, pay for health care and schooling. But I pitched that same question to Brian. I asked him what the biggest objection he gets to this is, and he actually said it comes from his father.
My dad says, we already have open borders already. These open borders policies the last 40 years have been a total disaster. Anyone who can run, jump, or swim here is already here. So I get this all the time. And, it's easy to think that we have an open borders policy when you take a look and say we've already got 11 million illegal migrants in the U.S. But probably the best proof of how strict our migration policies currently are is just to go and take a look at the prices the human smugglers charge. Right now, if you want to get smuggled in from rural Mexico to the United States, usually they'll charge about $4,000. That's about 3 years' wages for a rural Mexican farm worker. So if we're actually really the case that the border was already open, people would not pay 3 years' wages in order to get smuggled across. Something where that you have to do with great danger and where you only have maybe a 50-50 chance of actually even getting across. So, you know, like if you really think the border is open, you'd have to take a look at how much people pay to get across it. And that is really the best measure of how draconian existing policies really are. The fact that 11 million people are here is a testament to how much better things are here than in the home countries, not to how little we're trying to keep people out, because we're actually trying very hard indeed.
That's Brian Kaplan. He's an economist at George Mason University. Raymond, thanks.
Thanks, Anne.
So a world without national borders sounds like a really radical, futuristic idea. But Parag Khanna is a global strategist who believes that borders are already becoming irrelevant. He says borders are just imaginary lines on a map, and they are being eroded by the increasing connections between people. He told Steve Paulson how he would redraw the world map.
Borders are really just one type of line on the map, and in fact, they are mostly ghosts. At a day-to-day level, what shapes our lives more and more is infrastructure, by which I mean transportation, energy, communications, railways, highways, pipelines, electricity grids, internet cables. And by and large, more and more borders around the world are being transcended and paved over, literally, by all of this infrastructural connectivity. And yet most of our maps, no matter what country you're in, tend to just show the standard Rand McNally kind of, you know, atlas of the world that just has political boundaries. But if you were to draw an accurate map of everything that we as mankind have built, those things, put those on the map, and what you'll see is that we are way more connected than we are divided.
Okay, so give me some sense. If we can do this on the radio, I know maps are visual, but draw me a couple of alternative maps about how the world actually works.
Right. Perfect. Let's start right here at home. The United States is a major consumer of Canadian natural resources. And in fact, that is the most heavily transited border for trade in the entire world. You can draw that. You can visualize that. You can create a moving map, if you will, of all of the trucks and all of the pipelines and all of the oil and gas flows and so forth that are actually transcending that border every day. So why don't our maps show that? We have Google Earth Pro, we have Esri, we have all of these technologies that allow us to create accurate, three-dimensional, living maps that show us how the world really works. And I want us to graduate from what I call the X-ray map, which is obviously just this sort of dull black and white thing, to the MRI map. You know, that's much more detailed and much more kind of living.
There's so many ironies here because politicians are obsessed with borders these days. I mean, of course, this is, you know, what immigration policy is all about. You're saying that's mostly irrelevant?
It's irrelevant in multiple ways. It's irrelevant because it's wrong, right? It's factually wrong. The arguments that are made about the necessity of borders because they are based on, you know, sort of faulty data around, you know, what we are actually preventing. They ignore all of the good things and all of the ground reality. So if you look at border demographics, you see populations growing along borders, like the U.S.-Canada border, like the U.S.-Mexico border, like the India-Pakistan border, like the Norway-Russia border. I point to border after border to show that how come all, if we're supposed to be hostile towards our neighbors, then why are people moving towards borders? Because they want to be near markets. They want to be able to trade. They want to be near thriving cities. And those people don't care what side of the border it's on. The border is a friction. The border is a hindrance. The border is an obstacle that gets in their way. And then, again, there are all the things you don't see. American companies now are investing in the Mexican energy infrastructure. They're investing in the Mexican automobile industry, all of these areas where Mexico represents a huge growth market for American exports. Why would you want to put up a border? I mean, if you're a businessman, right? I mean, if you're a real businessman and you think in terms of trade and exchange and commerce, the last thing you'd want to do is to make it harder to trade with fast-growing markets like Mexico.
And yet borders are what define countries, right? And as far as I can tell, the governments of the United States, Russia, China, the EU, you know, go down the line, they still wield enormous power. I mean, they wage wars, they make trade alliances, they build infrastructure, they do all kinds
of
things.
I'm not saying that you will cast off the shackles of your national identity and that, you know, states and borders don't matter. I would never say that. I'm saying they are one layer. And again, think of history as sort of evolution and archaeology. We've had cities and empires and nations rising and falling for millennia. And what we're doing now is building so much connectivity between the major urban cities and population centers of the world that we're evolving beyond just thinking of ourselves as nations and states and borders towards a connected civilization of infrastructure and supply chains.
In my sense, I mean, your argument is that to some degree, the nation state is becoming less important. The city is becoming more important, especially the megacity, these huge cities
yes.
that sort of become entities unto themselves.
They already are, first of all. So this is not science fiction. Most countries in the world, most of the time today, rest on the pillar of one city that is not only the most important city in their national economy, but is a regional sphere of influence unto itself, like a Singapore or an Istanbul. So that city is not in any way constrained, if you will, by political boundaries. And in fact, if you look at the great cities of the world, they've existed for thousands of years, and their influence is totally regional, you know, like a London or of course, a New York or a Miami, a Paris, you know, and all of these places. Their identity or their role in the world is far beyond whatever country, you know, happens to supervise them nominally any given time.
Well, it makes me wonder if instead of, you know, the G20 or, you know, these global get-togethers of, you know, major nations, maybe there should be an alliance of global cities that come together.
Absolutely.
Because you're suggesting that's where the real action
and
is.
And that wouldn't be new either. I write in this book about the Delian League of ancient Athens. I write about the Hanseatic League of Northern Europe in the Middle Ages and what my wish for the 21st century is to have. Far more what I call diplomacity, you know, diplomacy among cities. Cities think so differently than countries think, and they think in a far more positive sum, mutually beneficial, commercially oriented, peaceful and tolerant way. And, you know, again, we only have all of our own histories of mankind as evidence of what I just said, with almost no exceptions.
So play this out for me then. I mean, if there were this connectivity between particular cities, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you see that? I mean, sort of draw the map again for it, like particular cities that are connected to each other.
It's already the case. Every global city by definition is a connected city because that's part of what generates your value. Dubai became Dubai, not because it has a large population. It only has, you know, 3 or 4 million people. But its airline connects to every major city in the world nonstop because of its geography. It's not a military threat to anyone. It's not even the capital of its country. But it has entered the ranks of the most connected cities in the world, and that's what makes it relevant. This is how cities think. We should want the world to move in this direction, and fortunately, it is.
I want to come back to your example of Singapore, one of the places where you now live. I mean, you said it's in some ways it's a model city, and yet I also hear there's kind of this authoritarian streak. You got to be careful about what you say. You can't really criticize the people in power. And I guess I'm wondering about the politics of all of this. I mean, you know, if we're tying so much of sort of our model of how the world works to GDP, I mean, what about other issues like freedom of speech, inequality, basic human rights? Mm-hmm.
We're not tying the model of how the world works to GDP. But that said, you know, if you think about the role of connectivity on rights and freedoms, you don't exactly expect a country like Turkmenistan to liberalize unless you're going to connect to it, right? Unless you're going to have more flows of information and trade and exchange. You can talk about it and badmouth it if you want to, but it's never really going to evolve in a modern direction, in a liberal direction, unless it's connected. Less connected societies have less of a stake in a peaceful international system. And so if you want to change North Korea, you want to change Iran, you want to change Russia, you can either threaten it or you can connect more to it. And that is a very, very concrete argument that I make.
Now, my impression is your analysis comes a lot out of your own life. You have lived in all kinds of cities in lots of different continents. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you've lived in Singapore, New York, London. I mean, it's as if you're...
Berlin.
I mean, it's
what a great city. Truly great city.
If you're not that attached to any particular country, it's like, I don't know. There's this, you know, people talk about being the global citizen or the cosmopolitan citizen. I mean, you're it sounds like.
Well, I suppose, but I mean, I don't view identities as being in competition. You know, I mean, I don't see why we should think about the 21st century as being wedded to the same ideological shackles as the 17th century. I mean, if you choose to see the world that way, that's your choice. But the world I'm living in and talking about, I'm not alone in, because there are 300 million people today who live outside of their country of origin. There are 300 million expats. And by the way, there are more American expats than ever in history. There are 9 million Americans living outside the United States. And, you know, you can have multiple identities today. The notion that they have to be exclusive to each other is just a very terrible ideological figment of one's, you know, historical imagination.
Well, it makes me wonder if national borders are going to become less and less important. Are we moving back to the city state? You know, the thing that you know, used to be around millennia ago.
Well, I'm very glad you used you know, the sort of the historical reference and said back to, because for thousands of years the city has been our dominant sort of unit, if you will, of sociology and obviously infrastructure and even politics to some degree. Again, modern nation states are just a couple of hundred years old, and most of them are really just a century old. Most of the countries in the world today were born after 1945, and I don't just mean most of them; I mean 2/3. Of them. And as you can see in the Arab Spring, a lot of them really aren't going to last that long, right? So we have to remember the way, you know, what our actual story is, not what our theoretical story is, not what our international law tells us. We have to think about reality. And so we are already moving back to this sort of, you know, city state. And I think that's a very positive thing, because, as I said earlier, cities want to prioritize connectivity. They cannot survive on their own. There is no autarky or self-sufficiency in a world of megacities. They thrive on relations with each other.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Parag Khanna. He's a global strategist and the author of Connectography. Coming up, we're going to tell a new story about immigration. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about a world without borders today. And the foundational story of America is that everyone wants to come here. That's what the Statue of Liberty stands for, right? This idea that for centuries we took in the world's poor and tired and huddled masses, people who came here and found a better life. Well, it turns out that history is kind of wrong. Tara Zara is a historian at the University of Chicago. She's one of those MacArthur Genius Award winners. And she studies the history of immigration in the 19th and early 20th centuries, specifically the period when hundreds of thousands of people from Eastern Europe were streaming into the U.S. And Tara told Raymond Tangekar that the story we tell about immigration looks really different when you tell it from the perspective of the people and the countries who were left back home.
What I was really interested in was the impact of this mass migration on the societies that people were leaving behind. And I like to think about the impact both in terms of the big scale issues, but also at a very local scale. What does it mean for that many parents to lose their children, or for wives to lose their husbands? Governments had a whole different set of concerns that animated this anti-immigration movement that I track. And there it had a lot to do with the perceived losses to the state that emigration brought with it. The loss of military power, for example, that suddenly conscripts didn't show up because they'd all run off to America, the loss of labor power, the need to pay workers more, for example, because suddenly you're competing in a global labor market. Religious authorities were really concerned about peasants going off to American cities and becoming demoralized and secularized in America. So there were fears about the moral and religious consequences. And in general, at the time, emigration was kind of largely seen as a loss to the state, that the state had invested in educating and providing for these citizens who then went off in their most productive years and contributed to the growth of another society or another state.
Well, and throughout the book, you rely on, you know, letters and court documents and other archival materials to kind of illustrate this, the idea that this was not looked favorably in Europe. Could you go into some of that? Like, what were the kinds of things that people were writing?
There were huge numbers of things going on. I mean, for one thing that it's important to think about is that at the time, the social security and welfare system in Europe was already much more developed than it was in the United States. So what a lot of people were talking about was the fact that, sure, if you go to Chicago or Detroit, you might earn a little bit more, but at what cost? Wealth isn't everything. And people started to think about the sort of human costs of this mass migration, that they were working long hours, that they were separated from their family and friends, that if they got in an accident, got hurt on the job, or got sick, there was very little support system in place to help them out. So a lot of the letters would say things like, America is great as long as you're healthy, but if you get sick, it's no place to be.
Well, there was a shocking statistic that you list in the book, and it kind of blew my mind. You say that 30 to 40% of European immigrants actually ultimately went back to their home countries?
That's right. And in some cases, that was really always the plan. And I think that's still true with a lot of immigration today, that people intended to come to the United States for 3 or 4 years, work as hard as possible, save as much as possible, and then go home to improve their situations there.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, if there's such ambivalence about life in America, why is there such cultural amnesia about this period? Why don't we actually see this as kind of a really complicated, complex time to be a migrant in America?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, if you look closely, we have lots of memoirs and fiction and documentary evidence that does illustrate precisely the point that, you know, conditions in the tenements of New York were really horrible. On the other hand, Americans are the descendants of the people who stayed in general. So for one, you know, we don't have as much of the voices of those who went home as part of our, you know, our own public culture here. I think that's a huge part of it. I think also, you know, and this is a really a positive thing in some way, that immigration, you know, at times it's always been a controversial issue and remains one. But it is part of America's idea of who we are.
Hearing you talk makes it sound like the U.S. had something, it almost sounds like it was an open border policy. I mean, that's probably an oversimplification, but it seemed much looser than it is now. And I guess I'm wondering when that changed, when the U.S. started to tighten its restrictions on its borders.
Until 1921 and then really 1924, I would say that the borders to the United States were relatively open for Europeans. For example, at Ellis Island, only around 1 to 2% of people were actually rejected. And otherwise, it was pretty easy to come to the United States and to come and go. That's the other thing. So this period in which 30 to 40% returned, that was partly because it was very easy to go home and then come back again. So people didn't have the fear that if they left, they would never be able to return. That all changed in 1924 with the introduction of the Quota Act, or the Johnson-Reed Act, which massively restricted immigration to the United States and introduced this system of racial or ethnic quotas, and particularly was aimed at suppressing migration from Southern and Eastern Europe.
And what was the underlying logic behind shifting to the quota system and restricting immigration in and out of the country?
Well, there were a lot of anti-immigration forces then, just as there are today. There were people concerned about protecting American jobs and so on and so forth. But I would say a lot of the concern was purely racist. It was about fears of racial degeneration. And at the time, East Europeans and Italians, Southern Europeans, were seen really as non-white people. So the goal of the Quota Act was to essentially freeze the demographics of the American population to what it had been in the early 19th century. So it privileged migrants from Northern Europe and from Germany and discriminated against those from Eastern and Southern Europe who were seen as less desirable, mostly on racial grounds.
So you've written this wonderful history book, but it's obviously a very timely subject. How has working on this book shaped your view on migration today?
I think it's fascinating how many of the same discussions and fears have played out. For example, in the early 20th century and then again in the 1950s, a lot of refugees coming from dictatorships, from Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, and then from communist regimes after the Second World War, were suspected of being spies or, you know, threatening politically, even though they were actually running away from these oppressive governments. And that was, you know, a constant force behind efforts to curb the admission of refugees. And you see the very same arguments today in the discussion of admitting refugees from Syria, for example. So that's really striking to me. But, you know, the other thing that I think is kind of interesting to think about in this story in terms of the current refugee crisis is that these countries that produce the vast majority of migrants throughout the 20th century are now, if you look at what's going on in Europe, often the most hostile to immigration, right? So Poland, Hungary, even the Czech Republic and Slovakia have been extremely reluctant, even by your, you know, global standards, to admit refugees. And that seems, I think, at first like a contradiction. But I think that this longer history of ambivalence about mass migration helps us to understand that animosity toward immigration today.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about this period, I think the conventional story, at least among a lot of Americans, is that Europeans moved to the U.S. in order to seek economic prosperity and freedom. I'm wondering, though, if this period of mass migration, if that in any way has actually shaped America's understanding of what it means to be free.
I think so. I mean, I think in the United States, in part due to this mass migration, but also you could think about other factors like the history of slavery in the United States or the history of the frontier. We have a strong association between movement and freedom, between mobility and freedom. But what you can see if you look at this debate from a transatlantic perspective is that there are also other ideas of what it means to be free. So there was always a debate here, and that in Eastern Europe, what a lot of government officials, but also ordinary people were saying is that real freedom is the freedom to be able to stay home and live in peace and security. And there are echoes of that sentiment today as well. There's, for example, a right to stay movement that makes precisely those kinds of arguments, that in an ideal world, there would be no mass migration. And that's an interesting thing to think about.
That's the historian Tara Zara talking with Raymond Tunkekar. Tara is the author of The Great Departure, Mass Migration from Eastern Europe and the Making of the Free World. So the story of immigration to America is still evolving. Right now, there are nearly 11 million undocumented immigrants living and working in the U.S. illegally. I want to introduce you to one.
My name is Jose Angel N., and I've been in Chicago for about 22 or 23 years. So I come from Guadalajara, and I came back in 1993. If you were to ask any Mexican back then what they will be doing with their lives when they came to the States, they will usually tell you, I'm going to go there, going to work a couple of years, come back, you know, with my money, I'm going to save it all, I'm going to open a small business, and that's what I'm going to live off of. That was my idea as well, but that didn't happen, obviously. I've held all different sorts of jobs. Like, you know, I remember working like one day in construction and then at the restaurant. Instead of being a dishwasher, I was promoted and I started working as a busboy. So instead of being in the kitchen, I was promoted to being in the dining room. And that's when, you know, I started knowing other people, kids who went to college and then came back. So I started watching these kids that will go off to college and then come back. And, you know, I saw them and I didn't think they were that different. And I was like, okay, if they can do this, maybe I can do it too. So I went to a community college. And I was really busy, you know, devouring those books. I mean, those books opened a whole new universe that I never knew about before because I had never had access to reading. And then it became an obsession. You know, somebody suggested that I should do a master's degree in Latin American literature, so I did. And doing my PhD right now is a continuation of that. But I didn't have any guidance. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that it was something cool and unprecedented in the whole history of my family and in my life. And it was life-changing to me.
This is Clark and Link. Transfer to orange, green, and pink line trains.
So coming to school from home, I usually get on the red line, and then I transfer to the blue line. It's a commute that takes about just over an hour, about an hour and 15 minutes or so. Typically, I read. I mean, that's time that I have to use to read and catch up with my classes.
Doors closing.
Being undocumented marks every second of my life. There's not one minute that I don't think about it. There's a whole lot of things that happen to you. Like, I was not able to go out with co-workers, for instance, and have a drink because I did not have proper identification. So, you know, for me, it was like becoming invisible a second time because, you know, being undocumented is already being invisible in a sense. But when you enter a different circle, when I enter the fairy tale of the American middle class, everybody assumed that I was documented, that nobody had any reason to believe that I was not. So it's the little things that you have to do on a daily basis that really get to you. Like whenever someone at work will mention something about an immigration rate somewhere, I will have to act all cool like nothing was happening. But deep inside, you know, I was anxious and nervous that will happen to me at any moment. So those are the sort of things that happen to me on a daily basis, among many others. You know, women talk about the glass ceiling, you know, I mean, in my case, it's a legal ceiling. And it was stigmatizing because, you know, I had gone through all the things that people who wanted to assimilate had to do. You know, they had to learn English, they had to learn about social values, American history, whatnot. So I'd done all that. But at the same time, you know, I was still not allowed to become part of this society, not a full member of this society. People need to keep in mind that when people like me work and have an employment, we pay taxes and we don't get any social benefits whatsoever. Many people, they call us criminals, they tell us that we're not immigrants to them. You know, to those people, we're not immigrants, we're criminals. So it makes me very upset, but I don't know how to put it, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but they think the laws and the books or abstractions are more valuable than the lives of human beings, flesh and blood. This is where I stay part of the week. This is our living room. You know, these are my daughter's toys. That's the little horse that she loves, and her kitchen. It's my reading chair. It's been challenging, but I'm very grateful that it's been challenging for me. I mean, I look at my family, and there's not one moment that I regret. You know, I look at my wife and my daughter, and I think about the opportunities that I've had because I've worked so much and so hard and for so long, and I have gone to college, and those are opportunities I wouldn't have in Mexico. When I first crossed the border, I never imagined I was gonna be sitting in front of you, you know, having this conversation in a language other than my own, explaining a situation that affects millions of people. We're hopeful that at some point this has to change. Because right now, the way it is, I mean, people don't think that people like myself are full human beings. They call us illegal for a reason. They see a morally inferior being in me. You know, you broke the law, you are morally inferior to me. So that kind of a stigma, you know, you carry it all the time with you. So all of that would change. We will have our humanity vindicated again.
Jose Angel N. He's the author of Illegal, Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. By the way, a quick postscript. Back in 2014, President Obama announced an executive order that allows undocumented immigrants like Jose Angel to stay in the country. It's currently being considered by the Supreme Court. Coming up, British novelist Sanjeev Sahota explores the lives of recent immigrants through fiction. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about migration and borders today. And of course, crossing a border is just the beginning. For a lot of new immigrants, the process of transitioning to this new country is difficult, even dangerous.
The restaurant closed on Christmas Day, the one day in the year when it did. And Dodgy spent the morning lying on the floor, on the blue sofa cushions, gazing up at the damp ceiling. There was no point in looking for any work today. He'd learned that much from last year. Ardashir sat on his straight chair at the window. After a silence of almost 2 weeks, the older man spoke. How long are you staying here? I can leave now. In England, I said. Until I've earned enough. Then you're a fool. The afternoon was quieter still, and as they sat down with the lamb curry brought back from the restaurant the previous night, all that could be heard was the dull scrape of metal on foil and the slurp and slop of eating. Sometimes a car went by. You're a bigger fool than me. I didn't have anyone to tell me different. Dodgy said nothing. Take my advice and go back now, before there's nothing to go back for and you're stuck here. It was the most he'd ever said to Dodgy. Perhaps it was this Christmas spirit everyone went on about. 33 years. Didn't do my papa's rights, my BGs. Wife and children started new lives. For what? So I can sit here in this hell. No future but death. Just a body needing to be clothed and fed. Go back. You understand?
That's an excerpt from The Year of the Runaways by Sanjeev Sahota. It's a novel that was shortlisted for last year's Man Booker Prize. It's the story of a year in the life of three recent immigrants to the UK. Now, Sanjeev is from an immigrant family himself, though he was born and raised in the UK. And the book is certainly timely, considering Europe's current migration crisis. But Sanjeev says that's not why he wrote it.
People say to me, you've written a very topical or a timely book. And I kind of say, well, that's sort of incidental. You know, the base is very personal. It's immigration's at the root of me. And, you know, if it wasn't for immigration, I certainly wouldn't be a novelist or writing books or living the life I'm lucky enough to be leading. So immigration, I think, has always been there in my background. And because I go to Punjab in India annually, sometimes once or twice, you know, a year, I've been there twice already this year. These stories, this sort of desperate need to get to the West, I've been hearing them for 15, you know, 20 years. It was inevitable that they were going to find their way into my fiction, given my own background as well.
Well, let's talk about some of your characters. There are these three migrants, young men named Tochi, Avtar, and Randeep. Who are they, and when the book begins, what's their daily life like?
Yeah, so there's Randeep, who's 19 years old, and he's made his way to England via a visa marriage. So he's married someone for convenience, a woman called Narinda, and he's living in a house with 12 other men. And Randeep's quite immature. He's not really adjusting to life in England at all well. There's Avtar. He's over on the UK on a student visa, though he's got no intention of... Though he tries, his main priority is to just work, and though he...
Well, he's working two jobs.
He's working two jobs.
And the only way he got to England in the first place is he sold a kidney to get there.
Yeah, right. He sold his kidney, and then he also took out a massive loan from the loan sharks, and to pay those loans back, He takes on two jobs because if he doesn't pay those loans back, his family's in danger back in India. And this is sort of the difficulties people find themselves into, and that they're willing to put themselves into, because they think the money that they earn in England will more than sort of cover their costs. It's like this Dick Whittington sort of esque thing of the streets will be paved with gold. But the reality when they get here is very different.
And then there's your third character, Dochi, who, unlike the others, he didn't come in order to try to make money and send it back to his family, because his family's gone.
You're right. For him, he's called a Jamar, a man from one from the lower castes in India. And you're right, his family are killed in a caste massacre. And he comes to England as a way to sort of just to prove himself as a human being, that he has as much right to make his own decisions in life as anyone else. There's a scene in the book which means a lot to me, when there's someone who he's been working for realises that he's of a lower caste, and she says to him, you know, who are you? And he says, I'm a man. And I think for him, that's what the journey's all about.
So life is so difficult for your characters. You know, they've got this daily slog of backbreaking, incredibly insecure work. I mean, they show up every day not knowing, are they really going to have this construction job or not? They also live crammed into this tiny apartment. They are tightly bonded and, you know, really close companions to each other, but they're also competing against each other for jobs. I don't know, is this, do you think, somehow characteristic?
I think so. I think it's when there's 12 men and there's one job, and they're all desperate for that one job, it's everyone for themselves. And I think, as one of the characters, Gurpreet, says, who's been in England for about 11 years, I think he says, the worst thing is that everything becomes a fight. Everything becomes a competition, fight for the next job. And I think it changes them in a way. Over time, it does it makes them bitter. And your sense of what's normal, I think, changes.
How many people like that do you think there are, just within walking distance, say, of your UK readers? Because I'm thinking that, you know, so often we unconsciously self-segregate, and there can be this kind of poverty and hardship one block over. But somehow we manage to live in such a way that we don't actually notice it.
Yeah, it's these hidden lives, I think. I think that's what one of the things I love about fiction is you try to dignify hidden lives that are otherwise going by unnoticed, or lives that are otherwise just pass us by, because we don't have the time or the inclination, or we're not looking hard enough. So you're right, these 12 young men, and there's no doubt in my mind that there's these houses with these young men in all the major cities in England. You know, this is happening.
How did you find out so much about what these young men's lives are, and what kind of research did you do to write the stories?
Actually, I go to India a lot. In that part of India I go to, which is very rural part of the state, these are stories that you hear, you know, in the bazaar, around the temples. It's a very open conversation, like all over that particular rural sort of part of Punjab.
What does it feel like for you? Because I was thinking, it must be difficult to be going back and to feel like you live a life of such relative privilege, simply because of where you were born. You know, and you're back talking to people who are suffering and living really, really difficult lives, also simply because of the accident of which country they were born in.
It is. It's deeply unfair. After I go back, whenever I go back to India, and it's interesting I say back, actually, given I was born in England, but whenever I go to India, it's a really live question inside me, that what do I owe? What, you know, for the children of immigrants in the UK like me, you know, what does it mean to be good? How is it fair that, as you said, just because I was born in one place, I can live one kind of life, and, you know, my cousins or, you know, people who are born in a different place, just because of a quirk of luck, really, aren't able to enjoy the same benefits that I can. And I can't really square that. I can't think of... for me, immigration, it's the basic question is a moral one. I don't think it's fair that I can live the life I can just because of something to do with luck. So that's, I suppose, my basic reason for believing that immigration is almost just a human right, really.
You said this is a question that lives inside of you, along with the question of what does it mean to be a good person or to live a good life, given those conditions. I mean, how do you answer that for yourself? Did you write this book out of a sense of responsibility?
I'm not sure I wrote it out of a sense of responsibility. I think once I decided I was going to write the story, I definitely felt a sense of responsibility to the people that I knew had gone through this life, you know, to honour it in a way. So once I decided I was going to write the story, there was definitely a moral dimension to how I tackled it, and that I didn't portray the characters as either, you know, as either heroes or villains. I just portrayed them as people first and foremost, and they do awful things to each other. They're not saints in any sense, but hopefully it's understood through what they've gone through and what they're trying to achieve. Yeah, the question of goodness and what it means to be good to me, it's one I, you know, wrestle with. I have, you know, connections in India, and, you know, each time I go back, you're constantly being asked to help or to do something or to sponsor them or to speak to someone. And you do what you can within the bounds of legality, I guess.
Did writing this book teach you anything you didn't know about the migrant experience? I mean, what do you feel like you learned over the course of writing it?
Yeah, I think writing a book, it's always, you start off with a set of questions. And so I started off knowing, you know, the whole topic of migration and immigration, and especially in this global world we live in, was complicated. And I think I've just finished the book realizing it's even more complicated than I thought. And if anything, I don't know if I learned, well, I suppose what I learned was just it's even more knotted than I thought.
Sanjeev Sahota, his novel The Year of the Runaways was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. That's it for today's show, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, just look us up on iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour, with help from Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Joe Harkey engineered today. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.